This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane in for Terry Gross. First ladies have played many roles through history, from presidential helpmate to outspoken activist. My guest, Carl Sferrazza Anthony, says that recent activist first ladies, such as Eleanor Roosevelt and Hillary Clinton, owe a debt to Florence Harding, whom he considers the first modern first lady. He details her accomplishments in his new book, Florence Harding, The First Lady, The Jazz Age, and The Death of America's Most Scandalous President. She was married to Warren G. Harding, whose administration was plagued with corruption, cronyism, and an oil leasing scandal, which came to be known as Teapot Dome. Harding is now considered one of the worst presidents in this country's history. I asked Anthony why it's taken so long for history to recognize the contributions of Florence Harding.
Well, I think there's a few reasons why she was forgotten. Number one, unfortunately, good public relations. And if you have people of a particular political persuasion writing that history and you're not around to counteract it, sometimes your reputation goes down the tubes. And Florence died 15 months after the president. A lot of her friends were in the thick of the really horrific scandals of the Harding administration, and I think because she had an interest in astrology and the supernatural, because she was married to this man who was been consistently rated the worst president, she's never been given any serious consideration on her own. She's always just been sort of this hatchet-faced caricature. And then contrasted with these young and very attractive sort of flappers who were Harding's assorted mistresses, Mrs. Harding in her Marcel Wave and pinched-nez glasses seems like a visually grim contrast.
You call Florence Harding really the first modern first lady. And reading about her accomplishments and reading about her interest in turning this office of first lady into something more than just cosmetics. I was very surprised, frankly, to read about what she brought to this office. Give us a sense for the various firsts associated with her.
I'm so happy you touch on that, because it is fascinating. She really saw an opportunity to use this position and turn it sort of back towards the people who had put her there. First of all, she was very grateful for the opportunity. And in a way, becoming First Lady opened her heart. And she very consciously wanted to make both herself in a real and physical way, as well as a symbol, and the mansion itself more accessible to the public. So that meant literally opening the gates, which had been closed during the Wilson years, allowing streams of tourists to come in. The house and the grounds were used, the grounds were used as a public park. The house was open to the tourists again. She often led tours. She actually touched people with her hand. She didn't wear white gloves and hold herself back with a little bouquet. She backslapped. She hugged. She clasped people's hands. And she asked them what was on their mind. She asked them about problems they were facing in their community. And she had, from the get-go, announced her commitment as an activist to the disabled veterans of the First World War.
Was she a popular first lady because of this?
She was an extraordinarily popular first lady. And this is what's really fascinating, because here you have just a few years before Edith Wilson being derided on the floor of Congress for running a, quote, petticoat government, as she managed, in a sense, the presidency rather secretly and furtively while her husband, President Wilson, suffered from his stroke. And then just 2 years later, you have Florence Harding talking publicly about how she was going to see to it that women were appointed to high federal positions, how she was going to lead a national boycott of women against the high price of sugar, how she was going to lobby Congress for the first federal reformatory prison exclusively for women, and how she was going to act as an investigator on behalf of hundreds of cases of veterans who had sort of fallen through the cracks of the system. And editorials praise her, and people praise her, and she is said to symbolize the new woman. And this, of course, is the spirit of the post-suffrage era.
She had a lot of power, as I understand it. She had the power and oftentimes made suggestions for appointments. She edited her husband's State of the Union addresses and other speeches that he gave. She even made decisions on which prisoners got paroled. This seems like an extraordinary amount of power for a first lady.
It does, but it gets back to that timeless issue of, you know, the boss's wife, and we've gone through it in varying degrees and in varying generations with Eleanor Roosevelt and Nancy Reagan and Hillary Clinton and Rosalind Carter, and even a little bit with Abigail Adams publicly and Mary Todd Lincoln. And we'll probably continue to go through it, and we'll go through it when we have our first gentleman.
She acquired the services, or actually hired on an astrologer, someone who would help her, I guess, what, consult with her, read the future for her. She believed in the supernatural?
Absolutely believed in it. And I think when one thinks about, when one considers the fact that she lived with death very closely every day, she had a chronic kidney ailment, which, although it did not leave her an invalid, certainly made her condition, her health, rather precarious, because at a moment's notice, if this condition flared up, her kidney could block and her system fill with uremic poisoning. I think this had a great effect on her, wanting to have a sense of control over the uncontrollable. And ever since her childhood, when her father used to take her out into sort of the bucolic countryside of outside of Marion, Ohio, where he would collect rents from the old German tenant farmers on his property, she would see the hex signs on their barns or the witch's ball in the kitchen window to keep evil spirits away. And so it was a lifelong fascination.
Did this astrologer have a lot of power in the White House?
The astrologer's name was Madame Marcia, and she and it was reported at the time. And in fact, letters of Mrs. Harding to the reporter were printed, and Mrs. Harding didn't seek to deny that she consulted Marcia. The astrologer advised the First Lady on appearances that the president should or should not make. Good days to meet with different kinds of people. And then as the political scandals of Teapot Dome and the Veterans Bureau began to break, the First Lady then gave her the readings to be done rather belatedly on cabinet members and advisors and whether they could be trusted.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. And our guest today on Fresh Air is Carl Sferrazza Anthony. And we're talking about his new book. It's a biography of Florence Harding. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Carl Sferrazza Anthony, and his new book is a biography of Florence Harding, the wife of President Warren G. Harding. When she married Warren G. Harding, she knew about his reputation as a womanizer, and he certainly didn't do anything to curtail his interests and his activities, which continued into the White House. How much was this public knowledge?
Well, many members of the opposition party, the Democrats, knew it, and several reporters knew it. Specifically, they knew about Grace Cross, who was his Senate secretary, and they knew about his long-term relationship with Carrie Fulton Phillips back in Marion, Ohio. Most people, I found no evidence that anyone really knew much about Nan Britton, the more famous of his mistresses at the time he was in the White House.
And Nan Britton claimed to have had a child with Warren Harding. She wrote a book about it, I believe shortly after he died, called The Presidential Daughter. What evidence is there that this child is indeed the child of Warren G. Harding?
Well, there's various forms of corroborative evidence that I have found that in the Harding papers themselves, actually, that give credence to Nan Britton's general story. A letter, for example, by a young woman by the name of Louise Biederhaus, who wrote to Harding saying, "Oh, I'm so happy to vote for you. I don't know if you remember, but we met at the typing class at the YWCA through our mutual friend Nan Britton." And Nan, of course, had written about this in her book, this meeting that taking him to the typing class. George Christian, President Harding's secretary, also told people privately that Nan Britton was telling the truth, that this was a relationship, and George would know because he kept the letters and the photographs carefully separated from other materials in the president's desk. So there's confirmation on the general outlines of Nan's relationship with Harding. Now, the fathering of the child, no DNA testing.
Yeah.
We don't know.
You don't know.
We don't know.
Were there Oval Office trysts?
There was, according to Nan Britton, a regular meeting with the president in a small closet in which an old leather couch would fit, which was connected to the Oval Office. This was corroborated by Alice Roosevelt Longworth, who learned about this incident from Ike Hoover, who was the chief usher of the White House. But some people still feel that Nan was not telling the truth and don't want to believe it, but there are various memoirs of White House staff people that confirm it.
What did the Republican Party and its officials do to deal with Harding's womanizing? And I know some of these women really tried to blackmail him and use their relationship with him to get money for themselves.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, a lot of these women were very demanding on Harding, I mean, for money and gifts and things. It seems to be a pattern with him. Carrie Phillips was the most incessant and the most successful. She demanded $25,000, and in this book, published for the first time, is Harding's capitulation letter to her demands for blackmail. He says he cannot personally raise the amount, and he asks her to hold off a little bit. He writes this in April 1920 until the convention, knowing, as did Florence, that if he's nominated as the Republican National candidate for president, that the Republican National Committee can raise the blackmail. And that is indeed what is done under the auspices of its chairman, Albert Lasker.
Well, it's certainly interesting to read about these scandals associated with the Harding White House and compare them to the accusations today aimed at the Clinton White House. What parallels do you see?
Well, I have to be very honest with you, and I know this is a disappointing answer for some people in the press. I don't see a lot of the parallels because looking at it from the point of view of today with Harding, we have some real documentation. We have affidavits that were prepared for Grace Cross. We have Harding's capitulation letters to Carrie Phillips and secret code. We have reports from others who were keeping tabs on Harding. We have the recollections of a reporter, Bertha Martin, and Evelyn McLean, a good friend of the Hardings, who really spilled the beans. We don't have that right now in the case of President Clinton. We have a lot of very detailed allegations. Now, I do see a comparison between Florence Harding and Hillary Clinton in that I see them both as part of a continuum with Eleanor Roosevelt, Rosalind Carter, to a certain degree Betty Ford and Nancy Reagan as well, women who had the courage to either publicly speak up on issues that were important to them despite whatever criticism might ensue, or women who behind the scenes were taking a very active role in the presidency.
But it is interesting to read about Harding and to read about these stories about his own personal life and to compare that to the stories, whether true or not, that are coming out day by day associated with the Clinton White House, that what's in the history books, which oftentimes gets muted over time, seems much more scandalous when it's in the current day news.
Well, I'll tell you what to me is the most interesting thing about all this is that with Harding, again, a Republican, the Democrats knew. I mean, people, the top leaders of the Democratic National Committee, including also President Wilson and his cabinet, knew, for example, about Grace Cross. And one of them, former Wilson Attorney General Mitchell Palmer, used the FBI to harass this woman, Grace, out of Washington during the campaign, blunting her effort to also blackmail then presidential candidate Warren Harding. And then later, after Harding is elected, these Democratic officials come to the president to ask that a prosecution be dropped against, in this case, Mitchell Palmer, based on the fact that they had gotten rid of Grace Cross. And Harding complies. And some of the reporters knew about it. So it's, you have the press, the Democrats, and the Republicans all in cahoots with each other.
Well, let's complete the life of Florence and Warren G. Harding. He died on a sort of under mysterious circumstances on a trip to Alaska, and this is back in 1923. Died suddenly and with some degree of mystery. What were the circumstances?
Well, it's exactly 75 years ago. Right now, he died on August 2nd. And for the week after that, the whole country was focused on this funeral train that was coming slowly back from San Francisco to Washington, D.C. Tens of thousands of Americans lining the train tracks and waiting for hours to get a glimpse of this. And by that point, the rumors had already started that Florence had poisoned the president. And what, in fact, had happened was that he had a very serious heart condition. He then had some crabs and had a touch of ptomaine poisoning, as did several others in the party traveling with him. They, however, recovered within a few days. Harding continued to complain of what he called indigestion. This Rasputin-like figure to the First Lady, a little homeopath by the name of Doc Sawyer, who had literally pulled her from what was a near-death experience in even the words of 1922, just several months before that. Mrs. Harding gives her tacit and complete support and approval of everything Dr. Sawyer does. And Sawyer begins treating Harding with heavy dosages of purgatives to flush these perceived poisons out of his system. Harding continues to complain of indigestion. The number two doctor, naval physician Joel Boone, keeping very assiduous notes on all this, is alarmed when he, without Sawyer's knowledge, examines the president's heart and finds it alarmingly enlarged. On the night of August 2nd, in the Palace Hotel, Sawyer gives Harding one more purgative while Boone is out of the room. Harding expires, collapses. Florence is in the room alone with him, thinking he's just fainted. Sawyer runs out to get what's called a restorative. Florence is alone in the room and realizes he's dead, comes out in the hall and screams for the other doctor and Boone. The genesis of this legend that she was in cahoots with Doc Sawyer and that she killed the president.
Was there any effort at a cover-up, considering some of the murky circumstances of his death?
There was an extraordinary cover-up. Not only was the First Lady an unwitting accomplice to a negligent homicide, she was part of a very careful and conscious conspiracy to cover up the details of his death, the medical incompetence, which would have not only embarrassed Sawyer, but some of the other consulting physicians, as well as the First Lady herself, who publicly would introduce this man as the man who can keep me alive. She refused to permit an autopsy. He refused to sign Doc Sawyer the death certificate, and she had the body brought back to Washington. And she said a lot of strange things, you know, at the time of his death. She would bring people over to the corpse and say he was magnificent in life. He was beautiful in life, but he is more magnificent still in death. And when at 2 o'clock in the morning, heavily veiled, wearing her diamond, along with Evelyn McLean in the East Room in this hot, muggy night with all these flowers, this cloying smell of flowers in the East Room. She raised the top of the coffin, and she began this two-hour monologue with the president. And she ended by saying, "The trip hasn't hurt you a bit. No one can hurt you now, Warren," and then turned to Evelyn and said, "Now that it's all over, I'm beginning to think it was all for the best."
Whoa.
So.
Pretty provocative.
Very provocative.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Carl Sferrazza Anthony is the author of Florence Harding, The First Lady, The Jazz Age, and The Death of America's Most Scandalous President. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.